welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss. We're on the second book of the collection called 40,000 Miles Around the World, and we're on chapter 24. This is the 17th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 24. The Great Barrier Reef, the Pearl and Bêche de Mer fishing industries of Thursday Island, a cure-or-kill remedy, and marine life extraordinary. On the following morning, we had lost sight of the New Hebrides and were sailing over the Coral Sea towards Rain Island Passage in the Great Barrier Reef. The Coral Sea is considered the most dangerous portion of the Pacific to navigation, owing to numerous small islands, shoals, reefs, and the strong currents prevailing there. However, by carefully manoeuvring our boat and keeping a sharp lookout, we got across without a hitch and safely arrived at the barrier. This great reef is unequalled for its vast extent and is a formidable obstruction to sea traffic. It runs for about 1,000 miles along the northeast coast of the Australian continent and extends still further to New Guinea. At low tide, the reef is nearly level with the water, and numerous small black coral rocks appear here and there in the heavy surf which ceaselessly breaks all along the Great Barrier. It is so low that it can be seen only within a distance of about 4 miles from a vessel's deck, and owing to the strong current setting through from the east, the passage is extremely dangerous after dark. Rain Island Passage forms one of several gaps which ships going east or west may use. The width of the channel is about 5 miles, and Rain Island, which is marked by a beacon, is almost in the centre. Shortly after clearing the passage, we sighted a schooner lying at anchor near a small low island. The wind being light and the water smooth, we sailed alongside, and on invitation from the captain, went on board. The latter was Japanese and from Thursday Island, the schooner's home port, and was engaged in fishing for bêche de mer, the edible sea cucumber so highly valued as an article of diet by the Chinese. All the crew were absent, plying their trade, and as the boats were at no great distance from the schooner, we could plainly see how these men went about their work. Each boat was manned by 2 naked divers, one rowing while the other would frequently dive and bring up some slugs. We stopped there for about 2 hours, watching the divers and talking to the captain, who was himself busy spreading and drying the slugs in the sun. I noticed several large sharks hovering round the vessel, and with regard to them asked the captain whether it was not dangerous for his men to dive whilst they were about. He assured me that he had never lost a man through the medium of a shark, although he had followed this business for years. This statement is in accord with my own observations. The surrounding water was infested with sharks, but, as in many other localities where there is every opportunity to feed on human flesh, the so-called man-eater never even attempts to attack a man. No doubt there are species more ferocious than others, but I have come to the conclusion that the average shark is not so bad as his reputation. After bidding farewell to the captain of the schooner, we shaped our course for Cape York, the northernmost point of the Australian continent, which narrows the Torres Strait to a width of about 100 miles. The weather was perfect and the wind moderate, and as we sailed along we passed numerous islets, some very low and without vegetation, while others were covered with coconut and other trees. Small schooners were anchored here and there, fishing for pearl or bêche de mer, and the ever-changing scenery made the cruise across the Great Barrier Reef a most delightful one. At dark, we anchored near one of the islets and stopped there till next morning, when we resumed our journey. At 10 o'clock, Cape York was rounded, and at 4 o'clock the same afternoon, September the 22nd, we arrived at Thursday Island. Here we were warmly welcomed by the Honourable Mr. Douglas, the resident magistrate, and the people, amongst whom there were many Europeans. In the evening we delivered a lecture on our cruise and illustrated it with the aid of lantern slides. At Thursday Island is stationed a large fleet of pearling schooners, small vessels of about 20 tons manned with a diver and 4 sailors. Some of the leading businessmen told me that pearling was a very profitable business. But sometimes heavy losses are sustained, for the weather is not always as pleasant as that we chanced to meet with at the pearling grounds, which extend all over the reef and the Torres Strait. A few years previous to that time, a typhoon had swept down upon the pearling fleet, and nearly 100 vessels and 400 lives were lost in a few hours. While in port, I received a letter from Auckland informing me that Buckridge had started for Europe in a boat called Kiora, accompanied by a mate. On the first day out, he had drifted ashore, but the boat was taken off and repaired, after which he had again sailed. On September the 26th, we took our departure from Thursday Island. A fine breeze blew from the southeast and the weather was splendid, so we stood in for the Arafura Sea and shaped a course towards the Cocos Keeling Islands in the Indian Ocean, the destination of the New Zealand fruitcake, which still lingered in our hold, to fulfil its destiny. The distance to be covered approximated 2,500 miles, and as the breeze stayed with us, we crossed the mouth of the Gulf of Carpentaria, a distance of maybe 300 miles, in fairly good time. It was on the third day out, and we were sailing near Wessel Island on the west side of the Gulf, that I felt a sudden attack of painful cramp in my stomach. There was a fair medicine chest on board, and I resorted to various kinds of medicine, which I deemed appropriate. But all salts, castor oil, and similar strong remedies failed to bring relief. We had plenty of tinned fish on board, of which I had frequently eaten, and some of it must have been bad and thus became the source of my indisposition. I suffered terrible pain, and as I was unable to secure relief, we steered in for Wessel Island, which we reached in a few hours. Luckily, we struck a good landing place with smooth water and a fine sandy beach clothed with bushy trees and green grass patches. We secured the tillicum, and with the assistance of Mac, I managed to get ashore. Under a shady tree, I dropped down on the grass. Added to the painful cramp, I now developed a very bad headache, and as by that time I was so weak that I felt sure my end was near at hand, I asked Mac to bring writing materials from the boat, as I wished to leave a testimonial to exonerate my mate from any blame in case I should die. Mac was squatting at my side, and on looking at him I could see that he felt nearly as bad as I did myself. "I think I know of a remedy that will do you good," he said. "Then let me have it by all means, whatever it may be," I replied hopefully. "Well, it will either cure you or kill you," Mac added. "Then you had better get me the writing materials first," I retorted, somewhat abashed. "I will not," he replied, "but we'll run that risk and administer the medicine first." And with that, he went off to the boat. Meantime, I lay there, rolling about in convulsions and thinking of the past, the present, and the future. The awful pain racked my body, and I yelled for Mac to hurry with his medicine, for it seemed to me an hour since he had gone. On his return, he said it had taken him 10 minutes to provide his kill or cure remedy, which consisted of a cupful of hot water and a tablespoonful of Coleman's mustard. These he mixed and ordered me to swallow immediately, and every drop of it. Now, a little mustard with meat is all very well, and a little too much of it, we all know what that means. But when Mac told me to swallow this concoction, I thought it would be impossible. Nevertheless, under the circumstances, and with Mac insisting that it must be taken at all costs, I raised the cup to my lips and drank the nauseous mixture. When half of it was down, it endeavoured to return immediately. However, I was determined it should not, and in this matter I was victorious. But the feelings that stormed within me, it is impossible to describe. Mac was kneeling by my side and had reverted to his former calling, as I faintly noticed. My inside felt a fire, and it seemed as if an explosion would take place in my stomach. I was just about to accuse Mac of killing me, when suddenly I became very busy. I could hear Father Mac praying that I might be helped out of my misery, and then Coleman got to work, and before 2 minutes had elapsed, nothing could possibly have been left in my stomach. I felt a wonderful relief, and after a short rest was myself again. "Well done, Dr. Mac." But the forced vomiting had made me very weak, so Mac went to work and made me a plateful of Quaker oats. This helped me to get to my feet again, and I soon began to feel as well as ever. It was nearing evening, and we had been ashore for 2 hours. The wind was very light and the weather beautiful, and as this was splendid camping ground, we decided to stay there for the night. The favourable wind continued next morning, and therefore, after having enjoyed a hearty breakfast, we each took a gun to do a little hunting, but the interior appeared to be sandy and barren, and we could not detect any signs of habitation. Nothing worth shooting was to be seen, and as the day promised to be very warm, we did not proceed further, but retraced our steps towards our little floating home, and were glad to be back, although without any game. At 10 o'clock, the Tilikum resumed her westward voyage under all sail and with a light breeze. During the following 2 days, we accomplished 100 miles of our course and were then becalmed for 3 days. During this time, we experienced the hottest weather on the whole cruise. If it had not been for the awning spread over the aft end of the boat, in all probability, we would have melted into grease spots. But by occasionally soaking the canvas roof, we managed to weather this trying time with comparative comfort. The sky was clear during the 3 days of calm, and with the aid of my sea telescope, we could see plainly to a considerable depth into the waters beneath us. It was here that I saw the greatest variety of sea life I have ever witnessed during my travels at sea. Some big grey sharks lay motionless quite near our boat, while others could be seen moving lazily to and fro further down. Each of the monsters was accompanied by a herd of pilot fish. The latter were small and striped greyish-black. About a dozen of them would busily ply round the head of a shark, sometimes entering his mouth, but soon came out again. On one occasion I noticed a shark 20 feet in length, apparently asleep within 5 feet of the bottom of the boat. Through my telescope I could distinctly see that his eyes were shut. The only part of his long body that moved was the tail, which slowly swung from side to side. His pilots, however, seemed to be on the alert. They kept swimming round the big fellow as if on the lookout for danger. It was a real piece of life in the briny deep, and when we had watched it for some time, I took an oar to give our friend a call. But quick as I was, the shark got out of danger before I could reach him. Besides the sharks and their pilots, there was a great variety of fish of different size and colour. These were either motionless or sluggishly moved about us, as if also affected by the heat of the day. I observed a yellow sea snake from 3 to 4 feet in length pass through the school of fish in a great hurry. There were many more of these venomous reptiles twisting and turning in all directions below, or whipping along almost on the surface of the sea. But one and all, wherever they were bound, showed the same haste, in contradistinction to the finny philosophers nearby. The appearance of these strange creatures was sufficient to give one the creeps. With the exception of the mermaid and the mysterious sea serpent, this representation of marine life seemed to be complete. Light, variable winds, alternating with more calms and most beautiful weather, followed. These conditions lasted for nearly a month. One evening I was sitting in the cockpit, smoking my pipe and waiting for a breeze to take us into the Indian Ocean. Suddenly, I felt a tremor through the boat, similar to an earthquake. "What is that?" Mac shouted out of the cabin where he lay in his bunk. "An earthquake," I volunteered, wondering myself what it could be. "Well, it must be a seaquake then," my mate responded. Just then we received another shock, and it dawned upon me that some large fish must be rubbing or bumping himself against the Tilikum's bottom, which caused her to shiver from end to end. So immediately I seized an oar and gave our unwelcome visitor, whoever it might have been, a good and hard dig in the ribs, which induced him to make a speedy retreat. Near Bathurst Island, on the south side of the Arafura Sea, is an expanse of shallow water called the Mermaid Shoals. I have been told by seamen that the famous mermaids there had their abode. Others connect the name with the simple report that a ship of that name had been wrecked on the shoals. Be it as it may, we decided to visit the place and altered our course to that direction. On approaching the home of the sea beauties, we parted our hair in the middle and made ourselves look respectable, as if going to a Sunday afternoon church meeting. When we reached the shoals, the wind became light and the water smooth, so we again brought our water telescopes in position and kept a sharp lookout for the ladies. We saw many fish loafing about, but whether they were mashers or not, it was difficult to conclude. As in other places, these waters teemed with life, but the mermaids were evidently out on a picnic, for we could not discover their whereabouts. Of course, it was an old story, my usual luck with the ladies. Chapter 25. In sight of the Cocos Keeling Islands. A miscalculation and its consequences. Tropical rains, and the New Zealand fruitcake arrives, but at the wrong destination. In such manner, we had spent a month on the Arafura Sea, drifting about and only occasionally helped by light winds, which gradually transferred us into the Indian Ocean. Then the southeasterly trade winds took us in charge and made the Tilikum again spin along at her best. The steady cool breeze came as a great delight after the hot time we had experienced in the tropical Arafura Sea, and we made from 130 to 150 miles daily towards the west. In the morning of November 8th, we sighted the Cocos Keeling Islands. When within 4 miles of the southeastern end of the group, the wind died out, and once again we were becalmed. "Just as the doctor ordered it," I said. "Now we have a few hours in which to clean things up and get dressed, and when the breeze comes in this afternoon, we shall sail into port in style and deliver our mail. But sailing vessels will always be the victim to uncertainty, and no one can really rely upon the time of their arrival." So it was in our case. I had made a mistake in the calculation. If we had known what lay before us, we could easily have pulled in to land, but we did not, expecting the wind to come up every minute. However, we drifted all afternoon, and to kill time put everything on board in order. The following morning, we found to our great surprise and consternation that a strong current had carried us nearly out of sight of the islands. During the forenoon, a light breeze commenced blowing from the east, and we tried to beat back again to Cocos Keeling. But despite all our efforts, the current forced us to the west, and the islands finally disappeared below the horizon. It was not only for the promise I had made the old lady at Nelson to faithfully deliver the parcel to her son, and which could not now be fulfilled, but still worse, we only had 8 gallons of fresh water left in our tanks, and the next land on our course was Rodriguez, a small island about 2,000 miles to the west-southwest of the Cocos Keelings. Calling to mind the good old lady who brought the cake on board, I felt sure that she would forgive me under the circumstances, but to start a 2,000-mile trip across the ocean with only 4 gallons of water per head aboard was somewhat disheartening. The weather was fine, but the light easterly breeze and current setting to the west made it absolutely impossible for us to return to the islands. I was fully aware of the fact that whatever happens on a sea voyage, be the vessel large or small, the master is responsible, and accidents will happen sometimes, but 9 out of 10 so-called accidents are due to carelessness or ignorance. When we sailed from Thursday Island, we had our tanks full, enough water to last us for 70 days. We were now 43 days out, and having only 8 gallons left, I could not help accusing myself of carelessness, and the weight of the thought lay heavy on my mind. The Tilikum was a poor vessel to sail by the wind, and to take a course for Rodriguez with the light breeze then prevailing and 8 gallons of water in the tank meant almost certain death from thirst. However, in going on, we had 2 chances in our favour. One, that we could be benefited by a strong trade wind, which would enable us to make the run in about 16 days, and by being economical, the water supply would just about last for the voyage. The second chance was the possibility of our meeting with rain on the passage. Consequently, we decided to reduce our daily allowance to 1 pint of water each and set off for the west. 1 pint of water per day is very little in warm weather, but circumstances compelled us to follow the lines we had laid down and use the little we had in a way that would give the best satisfaction for quenching our thirst. To begin with, we ate all our food cooled and without adding salt. Potatoes were boiled in salt water and eaten after cooling. Instead of consuming our pint neat, which would have been an unsatisfactory and therefore uneconomical way, we mixed half with a little oatmeal and used the remainder in making coffee. Both beverages proved to be greater thirst quenchers, and we drank sparingly. We also took frequent salt water baths and kept the deck and cockpit wet. Neither of us was in the habit of chewing tobacco, but at times, when our daily allowance was exhausted and we felt dry, we found that great relief was obtained by keeping a small piece of tobacco in the mouth. By adhering to these rules, we trusted that we would be able to keep alive for from 16 to 20 days, and in such condition as to be capable of sailing our boat to Rodriguez. The first and second days passed, and on the third, the weather was still warm and the wind light. Max said he would give £10 for a good drink of water. I would have given that myself, as water, under the circumstances, was much more precious than money. And if the Tilikum had been loaded down with gold and diamonds, it would not have made an iota of difference. We had to get along as best we could on our allowance. Our suffering from lack of water reminded me of Captain E. Reynolds, with whom I sailed as first mate when still quite a young man in the American ship Prussia. Captain Reynolds was at that time over 70 years of age and had been a master of sailing vessels for over 40 years. The old gentleman used to tell me, with a look of pride in his eyes, that during all those long years he had never lost a vessel nor met with a serious accident. When I joined the Prussia, I was, as already stated, very young and had had little experience in first mate's duties, and the old salt instructed me in what way he wanted to have things done in general. In particular, he dwelt on the water tanks as we were going on a long voyage. Be sure and see that our water tanks are in good order, properly cleaned and filled to the top with pure water. After our departure, a certain quantity is to be given out daily and no more. He was the same captain who made me a seaman. And though he has been dead for many years, I never forgot his teaching, and to him I owe thanks for having roamed the sea for many years in the same way as he did, without losing a vessel. Had I followed his instruction on the water question, there would have been no occasion for us to suffer. On November the 13th, 4 days had passed since we kept off to the west. During this time we ran off 200 miles of our course, indeed very slow progress. There were no signs of rain or of the light wind improving, so we did what people in Australia do during a long drought. We prayed for rain. It seems strange, but nevertheless true. The same night the breeze increased rapidly and the sky became cloudy. On the following morning we had all the wind our boat could stand under all sail, and to make things still more hopeful, heavy clouds darkened the sky in the southeast, a sure indication of approaching rain. Mac opined that our prayers were about to be answered. At noon the clouds hung over our head, but as so far as there was no rain, our midday meal consisted of cold, unsalted food and a little cold coffee as before. Meanwhile, the heavy clouds accumulated, and an hour later it began sprinkling. Not heeding the favourable and strong wind which sent the Tilikum along at her best, we lowered all sail and spread them over the deck to catch the precious fluid. We had hardly done this when the rain came down in torrents. While this lasted, we employed ourselves with buckets, and by 3 o'clock our water tanks were filled to the top. The wind kept fresh and fair, but with our tanks full, we were not in a hurry to get under sail again. First of all, we lit the stove to prepare a good drink. While thus engaged, I said to my mate, "I say, Mac, try to reef yourself through the after hatch, and right at the end of the boat you will find a square tin box. Fetch it up and bring it into the cabin." Mac, no doubt, had a faint idea that there was something good in the box, for without a word he disappeared, and in a few minutes I saw the box coming through the hatch and Mac's face behind it. "What's in this?" he inquired on entering the cabin. "I'll open it and see," I replied, and he certainly lost no time. There before us was a fruitcake, to all appearance as good and as new as on the day it was made. Mac looked at it in astonishment and believed it was God-sent. "Not exactly that, Mac," I assured him. "The rain was God-sent, perhaps, but this cake was sent on board by a kind old lady of Nelson, New Zealand, to be taken to her son, who is in the British Cable Service on the Cocos Keeling Islands. Therefore, it is not my property. But under the circumstances, what do you think we ought to do?" Well, the coffee was ready by that time, and Mac asked me to pass him a knife, and that he would then tell me what he thought of the New Zealand lady and her cake. And eventually, we were agreed that it was one of the very best we had ever tasted, and as we had been without such luxuries for so long a time, and being now provided with plenty of water, I'm sure neither Mac nor myself will ever forget how we appreciated the coffee and cake aboard our little vessel that afternoon on the bosom of the great Indian Ocean. And I sincerely hope, as there had been no possibility of my delivering the parcel, that the good lady and mother, on receiving my letter of explanation from Durban, South Africa, has forgiven me. The wind kept up its force and the rain continued pouring down, and after finishing our coffee we enjoyed a smoke and a sociable chat, congratulating ourselves on our good luck. Then we hoisted sail, and with the strong trade wind, The heavy rain preventing the seas from breaking, the Tilikum went flying to the westward again. The rain had been the most welcome occurrence that could befall us, and we therefore did not register any complaints when its ceaseless downpour made things rather uncomfortable for us. We simply kept a going and looked pleasant. It rained all the afternoon, the night and the next day, and when it did not stop on the third day, we thought that another great flood was descending and we might be doomed to sail forever. The wind stirred up a small gale, and only the heavy rain, by keeping the high seas from breaking, enabled us to keep our course. These conditions lasted a whole week, for 8 days, during which time we neither saw sun, moon, nor stars, and we were thankful when the rain ceased and the weather cleared. Then the wind died out, and we found ourselves becalmed once more in the finest weather imaginable. The first time since the rain had begun, we took our position and ascertained that we had made a little over 1,200 miles during the deluge. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.